Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington. Home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
On BreadboxMedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin again. So good to be back with you on Setting the Record Straight. And this is part two of our series about women, about the status of women. And in two podcasts, I can only touch on a tiny piece of the extensive interaction and effect of the Catholic Church on women and women on the Catholic Church. That's what this two-part podcast is about. About a very sensitive and very powerfully important topic, women, and the status of women, and the treatment of women throughout cultures, throughout the ages, for the last 3.5 million years. You hear frequent criticisms of the Catholic Church as being a patriarchy, but actually the Catholic Church is more than any other entity in world history responsible for elevating the status of women to where it equals that of men today. When people today complain about the patriarchy, in a way they're talking about the Roman patriarchy, because it's very visible. It's in their laws. The Romans had a superbly literate society. They codified laws in organized ways. And we can see the status of women outlined in those laws very clearly. But in actual fact, patriarchies are much older than the Roman Empire. Sometimes it's blamed on capitalism. Patriarchy is much older than that. It extends all the way back to the beginning of mankind and on back into animals even, into societal animals. At least hierarchies do. And the hierarchy is often a male hierarchy.
It is dogma in our public schools today that women in ancient times were oppressed because women had no voting rights. Women had not the same opportunities as men, and so forth. You would be mocked if you deny that this spells oppression. If you're a college professor and you deny it, get ready for the stake. But the charges are anachronistic and chauvinistic. People who make them never imagine what it was like for people of another culture to put food on the table, a roof over their heads, and clothes on their backs. Never mind bearing enough children to keep the population stable. Despite the fact that they treated their wives as property and not persons, it must be said, the Romans in general treated their wives with esteem. The matron of the house had better be consulted, along with the important males, if the paterfamilias was going to make a decision. Still, the Catholics preached that there was no separate baptism for men and women. All were one in Christ. If Christ was himself the Holy of Holies, then that inner sanctum was thrown open for all. Jesus had been seen on Easter first by women, then by his apostles. The Gnostic heretics, who disdained the body, have Jesus saying that one could not be blessed unless one were male. Christians condemn that nonsense. They did not commit infanticide by exposing baby girls, or boys for that matter, to the elements. They did not divorce their wives. They shunned sexual practices that put them and their spouses at risk. They honored women who defied emperors, centurions, and soldiers to witness to the faith. In his groundbreaking book, Confessions, St. Augustine wrote what many consider to be the first tribute in history to an ordinary woman, his mother Monica. without whose love and faithful prayer he would have never known the love of God. Even so, we might think of early Catholics as sexist because they, like everybody else, did not treat women as indistinguishable from men. That indifference is our politically correct ideal, though it's hard to name a time and place wherein women would not have decried such treatment as insulting. Over the last 2,000 years, this recognition of woman's equality has spawned a chain of most fortunate side effects as our governments and legal systems evolved in a long, slow process of catching up with the Catholic Church. And these effects occurred long after the Catholic Church itself had caught up with the full implications of Christ's gospel. On his flight back from Brazil recently, Pope Francis spoke to the press about women in the church. I will quote him. "The church is feminine," he declared. "She is bride. She is mother." He went on describing the importance of women to the Catholic Church. Many people welcomed this as a breath of fresh air. But this was nothing new. Pope Francis was reminding us of one of Catholicism's greatest strengths. Christianity, especially Catholicism, is the only religion that has, from its origin, insisted on the equal spiritual status of men and women. Adding to what has been presented previously here, the Roman Emperor Constantine's Catholic Church-inspired legislation removed prejudicial unfairness to women in the inheritance and ownership of property, especially nuns, by, quote, "removing penalties against the celibate and the childless by treating everyone as married before the law and every married couple as having children," unquote. They could pass on a full inheritance now to whomever they please. Constantine passed laws that permitted women over 18 years old to control their own property. In 414 AD, he made all contracts with women binding. He was the first to legislate against rape and sex with slaves. He denounced and restricted divorce done for trivial reasons, which previously had been a common male prerogative. He embedded Christian masculinity within the Roman legal system, encouraging sexual self-control, outlawing gladiatorial games and other measures that signaled that violence and sexual prowess were not the true measure of authentic manhood. I will explain in coming programs how these improvements in the status of women were to produce surprising side benefits in other areas. Let us move forward now to what is called the Middle Ages. But it's an absurd term, because the Middle Ages were those 1,000 years of Western history between 500 and 1500 AD that witnessed the abolition of slavery, witnessed checks and balances on absolutism, artistic achievements of medieval cathedrals, inventions of the book, the musical scale, and mechanical clock, and the liberation of women. Since we're talking about 1,000 years, one might ask, the middle of what? It's an immense period of time. Why is it then that the very term Middle Ages is equated, even in the minds of so-called educated people, with such ideas as feudal servitude, cultural darkness, massacres, famines, and plagues? The French historian Régine Pernod attributes such ignorance in part to classicism, which became predominant in the 16th century, reached its height in the 18th century, and is witnessing its demise in our own days. The revival of Roman law brought about legal standardization in the interest of centralized nation-states. The Roman notion of the unrestricted rights of property put an end to the legal rights enjoyed by the medieval serfs and feudal lords. The result was the reintroduction of slavery, the exploitation of the worker, the rise of the absolutist state, and the subjugation of women. Perhaps I should say the resubjugation of women. Women had enjoyed a higher status and greater freedom during the Middle Ages, during the subsequent period, the oft-praised Renaissance, in which the tide went out for them. For women, it meant a return to a lower status with the reintroduction and revivification of Roman law. Régine Pernod argues well that the Middle Ages were in some ways closer to our own age than were those ages formed by this classical spirit. The 1,000 years in question saw the first appearance of the French courtly lyric. It has been studied in all its origins and evolution by scholars of the Romance languages. The Sorbonne, as it is today, has carefully snubbed these. It would be difficult to find the truth at the Sorbonne, that the venerable institution was founded by a priest, and this is what the Sorbonne has become. If you find this statement unbelievable, then research it yourself. The renowned College of La Sorbonne in Paris, founded in 1257 by the priest who was the chaplain of Louis IX. We know him as St. Louis. St. Louis, Missouri is named after St. Louis. We should all revere him as the great Catholic king of France, Louis IX. St. Louis, king of France. The priest's name was Robert of Sorbonne. He formulated the central idea of the future college system in exemplary fashion, a formulation which implied the existence of a study community organized in the form of a brotherhood and living together and regulated in moral fashion. That we are indebted to the Roman Catholic Church for the creation and maintenance of the great university systems of the world is the subject of a future program. But let us talk about lyric poetry. It is not easy, nevertheless, to maintain a complete silence about the greatness and reverence expressed in these lyric poems. For women and womanhood, and for the elevated status that they now occupied at this point in history. There is a study by a man named Retro Bezzola that makes a kind of panoramic digest of the whole of lyric poetry for the late Middle Ages up to the 12th century. They are beginning to be known here and outside the hermetically sealed atmospheres of today's university campuses. The author unfolds for us the evolution of medieval letters, first in Latin, then in the two languages of Old French. One is startled to note that this poetry, in its expression and in its development, is intimately linked with that of the arts in general. The first expression of this courtly lyric poetry is manifested at the end of the 6th century with Fortunatus, who addresses to the nun Radicum, the foundress of the monastery of Saint Croix in Poitiers, as well as the abbess Agnes, some Latin verse in which are already expressed sentiments dear to the poetry of the troubadours and trouviers of the 12th century. This previously unknown inspiration, derived essentially from a new regard with respect to women, henceforth women were addressed with a respectful tenderness. Thus, in this world that so often is described for us as a battlefield, where barbarity confronts tyranny and vice versa, is born this sentiment of extreme delicacy, which will make the idealized woman and the real woman a sovereign, a feudal noble to which great respect was owed. It was the age of chivalry. It was the age of the art of praising women, of venerating womanhood. One should never underestimate the power of the arts to transform behaviors in society. And it did. One should never underestimate this age called the Middle Ages. Perhaps the 12th century was the most civilized era of European history. It was an era in which the term Europe and Christendom and Roman Catholic Church were synonyms. There were different terms indicating the same thing, the same entity. The mission that Christ gave to his church with regard to women, in regard to the chivalric respect with which we should hold women and protect women, as Christ exemplified in his life, was fulfilled then. It was the High Middle Ages. Women had an enormous status that they have long since lost in the decay of our modern era.
So where are we on the calendar of time? We began with the emergence of Christianity in the first century.
We had progressed from the age of Constantine into that wonderful point in history where there was a great flowering of Catholic philosophy, and Catholicism spread throughout the world that had been the Roman Empire and beyond. And the status of women was correspondingly elevated. It is interesting from our perspective to look back upon the Middle Ages. It is often divided into two periods. The first period is called the medieval period, and the second is sometimes referred to as the age of feudalism, of the feudal kingdoms. In a recent year that had been declared the year of the woman, there were many symposiums, treatises, colloquia, and seminars of all kinds. And in these, the rate of references to the Middle Ages became staggering. The image of the dark and shadowy Middle Ages, from which we have finally arisen, like truth emerging from a deep well, was a prelude to all the presentations. In fact, the status of women in Europe in the Middle Ages is a nearly new subject. Few serious studies have been devoted to it. Would you be surprised to learn that, in fact, in feudal times, the queen was crowned just like the king, generally in cathedrals of the royal domain, but always at the hands of the archbishop? As much importance was attached to the crowning of the queen as that of the king. It was only in the 17th century that the queen literally disappeared from the scene, and we had the appearance of the, quote, favorite, unquote. This mention of the status of queens gives an accurate enough idea of what happened for women in general. The place they held in society, the influence they exercised, followed an exactly parallel line. While women like Eleanor of Aquitaine or Blanche of Castile really dominated their century, while they unquestionably exercised power when the king was absent, sick, or dead, the woman in classical times was relegated to the background. She exercised power only in a hidden way and found herself excluded from any political or administrative function. It is, as always in the history of law, that we must seek the facts and the meaning of the facts. In other words, the reasons for this decline, which became, in the 19th century, that's very recent, the 19th century, became the total disappearance of the role of women. Her influence diminished in direct proportion to the rise of Roman law in juridical studies, then in institutions, and finally in customs. It was a progressive obliteration whose principal stages one could follow very easily. Roman law, whose influence is seen reborn in Italy, particularly in Bologna, was the great temptation of the medieval period. It was studied with enthusiasm, not only by the urban bourgeoisie, but also by all those who saw in it an instrument of centralization and authority. It showed, in large part, the effect of its imperialist, and let us say the word, colonialist origins. It was the law par excellence of those who wanted to affirm a central state authority. The Emperor Frederick II, governing the German countries, made it the common law in the 17th century. Roman law was taught at Toulouse, favored by the infatuation felt in the 16th century for antiquity. It began to penetrate the customs and modify the habits and mentalities of the people themselves. Now, Roman law is no more favorable to the woman than it is to the child. It is a monarchical law, which allows only one single end. It is the law of the paterfamilias, father, proprietor, and in his own home, high priest, the head of the family in what concerns his wife and children. The influence of this renaissance of Roman law was so sweeping and powerful that by the 16th century, the age of majority, or the rites of maturity, which for the most part was 12 for girls and 14 for boys, was returned to the very age fixed in Rome, 25 years old. Well, this was a clear regression from what had been customary. The Napoleonic Code put the final touch on this system and accentuated tendencies that had begun to assert themselves from the end of the medieval period. It is surprising to realize that it was only in the 12th century that the custom began of requiring the wife to take the last name of her spouse, and also that it was only with the Council of Trent, thus in the second half of the 16th century, that the consent of parents became necessary for the marriage of children. A word on arranged marriages. One power fought against these imposed unions, and that was the Catholic Church. She increased the number of causes of annulling a marriage in canon law, never ceased to claim freedom for those who were pledged to each other, and often proved rather indulgent in tolerating the rupture of imposed bonds, much more at that time, we should note, than later. It is an established fact, taking from simple evidence, that everywhere progress in free choice of a spouse, that had followed on the progress of the spread of Catholicism. It was possible in the Middle Ages for a woman to exercise extraordinary power. Certain abbesses were feudal lords, whose power was respected equally with that of other lords. Some wore the cross just like a bishop. Women often administrated vast territories with villages and parishes. The life of an abbess of that period included a whole administrative aspect. Donations were accumulated that allowed the collection of a tithe on a vineyard, or perhaps the right to rent on hay or corn, or perhaps to have a barn and a right of pasture in the forest. Her activity was also that of an owner, indeed of a lord. This is to say that abbesses, by their religious functions, exercised, even in secular life, a power that many men would envy today. These abbesses were, for the most part, extremely well-educated women who could have rivaled the most learned monks of the time in their knowledge. Heloise herself knew and taught Greek and Hebrew to her nuns. It was from an abbey of women, that of Gandersheim, that a manuscript came in the 12th century containing 6 comedies in rhyme prose, in imitation of Terence, that were written by the famous abbess Roswitha. These 6 delightful comedies, penned by the abbess Roswitha, are considered the first modern plays, the first dramas, after an interval of 1,000 years when there were no such plays. These plays are considered one of the main foundation stones of modern German literature. In the nunnery, Roswitha developed her intellectual skills and eventually became a canoness. A canoness could leave the convent for outside visits, thus giving Roswitha the chance to view the world beyond the abbey, and the knowledge to create her long epic poem detailing the rule of Otto I the Great. She also wrote poems and the plays we talked about. Not all have survived, but those that do deal with the battle between Christianity and paganism, the lives of saints, and of heroic frail women who victoriously defend their virtue against strong men. Roswitha gave herself the title the Strong Voice of Gandersheim. Gandersheim was Saxony's most important nunnery. Gandersheim was recognized as a center of intellectual and religious activity. It had close ties to the German Holy Roman Emperor Otto I at Reichenau. Otto I gave abbesses their own court, knights, and the right to coin money and attend the meetings of his diet. The diet in Germany was a ruling and legislative body like our Congress or Parliament. And in these diets, these women, these abbesses, had a vote, and their vote counted the same, was equal to the vote of the men, the lords, who were seated next to them in the diet. Given the great intellectual tradition of the nuns and the abbesses, it's not surprising that the best-known encyclopedia of the 12th century came from an abbess, Herod of Landsberg. It was the famous Garden of Delights, from which scholars draw the most reliable information about the state of technical knowledge of that time. Just as much could be said for the works of the very famous Hildegard of Bingen. Another nun, Gertrude of Helfta, in the 13th century, tells us how happy she was to pass from the state of grammarian to that of theologian, which is to say that having gone through the stage of preparatory studies, she reached the highest stage, like that studied at the university. This proves that in the 13th century, convents of women were still, what they had always been since the time of St. Jerome, centers of intellectual activity and learning. Sacred scripture was studied there, but also the religious were educated girls. Entering a convent was a normal path for those who wanted to develop their knowledge beyond the usual level. Yet there are more surprises. If one wants to get a clear idea of the place held by women in the church in feudal times, what if now in the 21st century, the monks in the monastery were placed under the authority of an abbess, of a woman? Would this go down easily and be accepted in our modern time? This was, however, achieved with great success and without providing the least scandal in the church in the supposedly backward 12th century. For example, in France, there was a double monastery, one for men and one for women, that was placed under the authority not of an abbot, but of an abbess. The latter, through the will of the founder, was to be a widow, having had the experience of marriage. Let us add, to complete the picture, that the first abbess, Petronilia, was 22 years old. Maybe our times finally are catching up with the Age of Illumination.
Yes, the Age of Illumination. Never heard of it? Well, okay, I'll admit it. I made up the term, but I like it. To me, it seems to fit. It fits the 12th century, an age where we had a fusion of faith and reason, the motto of the Catholic Church. It was the true enlightenment. The true enlightenment, as opposed to what we call the Age of Enlightenment, I consider the darkening. Yes, the darkening. Because it was an age of reason alone, in absence of faith. Light from within and no light from without. Like one was walking through the countryside on a dark, dark night with a good flashlight. And you could see a bit. As opposed to the age of faith and reason, when you were in the sunlight, the light from the entire universe, God's lamp. So in this age, the age of illumination, the 12th century, there was a fusion of spiritual light and knowledge with intellectual light and knowledge, a fusion of reason with the witnessing of God, with God witnessing us. When we go to adoration of the Eucharist and have benediction, we are eye to eye with the Creator. God bless us all. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.